What's up? Oh my God, we're back. We're back at it. We're on the internet. We're on TikTok over here. We got like 160 people over on TikTok chilling, ready to listen to the podcast. We got nobody on YouTube yet, but I'm sure if you're watching this tomorrow or the next day or in the future on YouTube, then it doesn't really matter. You're here. Or if you're listening on Spotify, hi. Welcome. We didn't do an episode last week. I was out of the country. Didn't feel like recording. I thought for a second maybe I would bring like a field recorder with me or record things on my phone, interview people on the street in Ireland, interview my drivers. And I just thought it's just too I really didn't want to be making content while I was out there. I just didn't want to be making content. I just wanted to be on the trip, seeing new things, immersing myself in a new environment. So I didn't really do anything. I didn't really shoot any videos, didn't make a podcast, but we're back, all right? We're back and right out the gate on this episode from a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood. It's People Pleaser. Right out the gate, we got huge news, massive news right out the gate. First of all, first part of this news is my album, Beautiful Things, the Deluxe Edition, is streaming on Spotify and Apple Music and all the places tomorrow, Friday, August 12th. So if you're listening to this on Spotify right now, it already is Friday. You can literally listen to it right now. If you're listening to this anytime after August 12th, Friday after August 12th, it's out. The album's out. You can go listen to it. It's the remastered, the digitally remastered version of my album, Beautiful Things from 2020, plus six additional new tracks. And those six new tracks are bangers. Those six new tracks are absolute fire. I'm really, really proud of all of them. And I'm really, really proud of the story of this record and how it came together. So that's the first part of the news, is the album is now streaming. You can go listen to it. Here's the second, more exciting part of the news. There has been a saga with this album. I have been trying to get it printed as a double vinyl for some time now. Some of you may have been following along with this saga, and some of you may not have been, but I've been trying to get this album made into a double vinyl, and I thought I found a distributor that would do it. It wound up that they were booked out for like a year and a half after I had already gone through this whole process with them, and I was like, okay, well, that doesn't really work. Then I figured out that Bandcamp, my favorite place to sell music, Bandcamp actually has a vinyl program now, and they're handling all of it. They're printing it, they're distributing it, everything. And so I decided to release it through Bandcamp. Little did I know, though, I went through the whole process of creating the campaign for the vinyl on Bandcamp, was ready to launch it, released the album on Bandcamp. I did this like 2 months ago, told everybody that follows me on Bandcamp, hey, you can come get this double vinyl. It's here on Bandcamp now. And Bandcamp informed me that I was not eligible for their vinyl program. And I was like, oh my God, I wish I would have known that before I did all this stuff. So I reached out to Bandcamp. I was like, hey, I already told all of my followers that I was doing this through you guys. I'm always hyping you guys up on my channels and everything. Can you make an exception for me? Can you let me through? They said they would let me make a campaign and they would review it. It took them forever to review it. They sent me, you know, corrections that I needed to make. I made all the necessary corrections. I heard from them last week. They approved my campaign. So tomorrow, August 12th, on the same day that we're launching the album on streaming services, we are launching the campaign for the double vinyl on Bandcamp. It's happening, and I need y'all to come through for me, okay? We have 30 days to make this thing a reality. In 30 days, I need to fulfill enough orders on Bandcamp for them to justify the cost of printing the records and sending them out. I think what I need to sell is like 100 records. So like 100 people need to order this thing over the next 30 days. And if that happens, then Bandcamp's gonna print them and make them and send them to you. And they are dope. They're so, I got to like hand design all of these. I got to design what the vinyl is going to look like. So there's two records. One of them is blue, one of them is pink, and they each have a splash of the other color. So like the pink one has a splash of blue and like a darker magenta on it, like almost like a tie-dye splash. And then the blue one has a splash, a tie-dye splash of like pink and magenta on it, and they look beautiful. They're gorgeous looking. The album design is gorgeous. The album art by Tanner Allen looks gorgeous. The back art came together really well, the back side of it, the inside, the inserts, and all that stuff. It's all looking like really, really good. I think it's going to be a really, really cool thing to own. There is only going to be 200 made total, so regardless, if you get one, you're going to be owning one of 200. Like, you'll be one of only 200 people that will own this limited edition double vinyl. Mostly, I'm just excited for it to exist. I really believe that we can fulfill these orders. I really believe that we can get this done. But 30 days, the clock starts tomorrow. Tomorrow, Friday, August 12th, the album will be available to stream on Spotify and Apple Music, and you can order the double vinyl and make this happen. I just wanted a vinyl version of this album to exist, and I couldn't believe how difficult the process was. And now we're here. It's happening. Very excited about it. So that's that news. Thanks for bearing with me on that. Moving on to my next segment. I've been doing a lot of Bad Take Brigade, you know? I've been doing a lot of the Bad Take Brigade, but I think I need an antithesis to Bad Take Brigade. So we do have Bad Take Redemption, but I think I want to start a new segment that's called like Baller Clip of the Week. Like big ballers of the week. I should have figured this out before I started the podcast, but it's the baller, big baller, big daddy baller. No, that's because that's sexist. Am I overthinking it? It should just be baller of the week, right? Baller of the week. Okay, baller, that's what it is. Baller of the week, all right? This week's baller of the week, and I'll come up with a sound drop for this one too. It'll be like, it's the baller of the, or like, it'll be like, it's the baller of the week. That's what it's going to be like. It's the baller of the week. This week's baller of the week is candidate for governor of Texas. Baller of the week, this is Beto O'Rourke.
I'm going to make sure that now 11 weeks since we lost 19 kids and their two teachers shot to death with a weapon originally designed for use in combat, legally purchased by an 18-year-old who did not try to obtain one when he was 16 or 17, but followed the law that's on the books, ladies and gentlemen, that says that you can buy not one, you can buy two or more if you want to, AR-15s, hundreds of rounds of ammunition, and take that weapon that was originally designed for use on the battlefields in Vietnam to penetrate an enemy soldier's helmet.
Have you seen the clip? If you've seen the clip, this is my favorite part of the clip, is when he goes down on a knee and he says, to penetrate an... Hold on, I'm going to pull it back here. Let's see this part.
To penetrate an enemy soldier's helmet at 500 feet and knock him down dead.
To penetrate an enemy soldier's helmet at 500 feet, and he goes down on his knees and he like puts his arm out like a spear. That's my favorite part of the clip. Well, that's my second favorite part of the clip. My favorite part of the clip is coming up right now.
Down dead, up against kids at 5 feet. It may be funny to you, motherfucker, but it's not funny to me, okay?
Baller of the week, dude. Baller of the week. I was not ready when that clip first showed up on my For You page. The thing said, like, watch Beto's reaction to this right-wing heckler. I thought he was going to say something like, well, you know, that's just your opinion, sir, or something. Like, I was not ready for, it may be funny to you, motherfucker, but it's not funny to me. I was not ready for that. And instantly I was like, oh, this guy's so fucking cool. I love this guy. I already like Beto a lot. I will say this. Beto has done way more in the wake of Uvalde for the community of Texas and the people of Texas and the hurt and the pain that community has suffered than Ted Cruz or Greg Abbott combined. In the way of just showing humanity and compassion, This is such a great clip. It's such a fantastic clip. I love how unpolished it is and how improv, how off the cuff it feels. Now, there's a lot of speculation on whether or not this is a setup. You know, there's people on the right, which I could say that this is the bad take brigade of the week. All these people on the right who are saying that the guy who laughed. So that's what happens in the clip. You have to listen really closely, but you can hear someone laughing in the background when he gets done kneeling on the ground and going, "Penetrate an enemy soldier at 50 feet away." He stands up and there's a guy that cackles. There's somebody that goes, "Ha, ha, ha, ha," like that. Because it's really funny what he's talking about. He's talking about, you know, the purchase of weapons that have been used in multiple school shootings to kill countless kids while they were at school. And he's talking about that, and someone found that really funny that he was talking about that. And there's all these people on the right that are saying that that person who laughed was a hired actor so that Beto could have this moment, this viral moment. First of all, I think it's really, really funny and telling that the current response from people on the right, anytime they're caught on camera behaving the way that they are, anytime someone from their group is caught on camera behaving in a way that shows them to be what they are, which is kind of morally reprehensible people, their instant response is, well, that must have been actors pretending to be us. So this is what happened with January 6th, right? Was, oh, well, that wasn't us. That was Antifa dressing up as Trump supporters and storming the Capitol. Even though they had been openly planning this for weeks, they had been openly talking about it on the internet, saying, hey, we're going down to the Capitol on January 6th, and y'all better get ready because you've never seen anything like this. Here it comes. And then when it was on TV for us all to watch it, and they could look at it, they could see the footage, and the mirror was held up to them, and they could see how ugly they looked and how despicable they looked and how reprehensible their behavior was, the only explanation they had was, well, that must be people on the left dressing up and pretending to be us. So that's exactly what's happened here with this Beto clip. Is you have a clip where you can hold up a mirror to someone and show them, is this you? Is this you laughing about children being killed in school? Is that the kind of person you are? And the only logical response they can think of is, oh, well, that looking at the mirror, seeing it, really seeing it for what it is, oh, well, that must be a crisis actor or an actor pretending to, you know, so that Beto can have this moment. Now, listen, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility, or what do I mean to say more accurately? I don't think it's uncommon for campaigns to manufacture moments along a campaign trail. I think that it's a large part of what campaigning is manufacturing viral moments, especially in today's political game. Manufacturing like meetups between a candidate and someone where there's like something that looks really organic and looks like it happened off the cuff, but it's all part of a strategic plan of how we talk. Like, they plan for every contingency. What is our operation when this happens? What is our operation when this happens? What is our response when someone says this? What is the response when someone asks this question? They plan for every contingency and they think, what's the way that we want to come off? So I don't think that it's beyond the realm of possibility that Beto's campaign has greenlit the use of language like, listen, motherfucker, you know, might be funny to you, motherfucker, but it's not funny to me. That they might have strategized and said, hey, if a situation comes up where someone's being particularly inhumane or lacking in compassion or empathy when it comes to gun violence, you have the green light to light that motherfucker up. And I don't think that that's necessarily, like, this is part of the political game. So I don't necessarily know how quote unquote organic the moment actually is. I will say, as an actor, as a storyteller, as a theater maker, and as a person who and a filmmaker, it feels organic to me. It feels real, and everything about Beto feels very real. So either Beto is a really good actor, or he is a genuine person. I think people like Beto O'Rourke are really refreshing to see in politics. People who, when they speak and when they they're at events like this, it really feels like this person is getting involved in this thing because they actually have strong beliefs that they can affect some change for good. So obviously none of us can actually tell whether or not that moment was as organic as it appears, but I have no problem believing that there was a right-wing heckler that laughed at him while he was describing what AR-15s are, because right-wing gun nuts love to make fun of the lack of gun knowledge from people on the left who oppose guns and who want stricter gun laws. And so I think that that's more likely what that person was laughing at, is Beto was describing AR-15s as a weapon that was originally designed to penetrate the helmet of enemy soldiers and stuff. And this person's probably just laughing at, like, there's probably something that this person thinks he's getting wrong about the gun, and that's more likely what they're laughing at. Either way, it's a really inappropriate and callous time to laugh. And you see the reaction from the room there. And if you look at the people in the room, the people in the room look like good old-fashioned Texaners. Like, they look like Texans. They look like conservative Christian Texan people. And they all stand on their feet and give him a standing ovation when he turns to that person and says, "Might be funny to you, motherfucker, but it's not funny to me." And I join them in that standing ovation. I think it's an awesome clip. I think it's a badass clip. I think I kind of wish Beto O'Rourke could just skip the Texas gubernatorial race and we could just have him as the 2024 candidate for president, even though I know that they're going to shove Joe Biden back down our throats, because even though they kind of said that they weren't going to do that, they said that he was going to be a one-term president, but we all knew that he wasn't going to – that they were going to run him again. And it looks like that's what's going to happen, and we're just going to have to deal with it. But maybe in the future we'll get a Beto O'Rourke run or someone like him. Somebody, it's rare to see someone like that with so much character. So that's baller of the week, Beto O'Rourke. I don't think that it was a hired actor who laughed in the audience. I do think that maybe the campaign. Oh no, I want to say this too. If his campaign has approved language like motherfucker, I think that's really cool of his campaign. I think that whoever's running his campaign has the right idea. And if the left is going to compete with Trumpism, the thing that people like about Trumpism, I think the thing that really hooks into people about Trumpism is the casting aside of any kind of, pomp and circumstance about the presentation of the candidate. He just sort of speaks off the cuff and is who he is, and that's what people like, is that he doesn't feel polished. He feels rough around the edges. And I mean, early on, when Trump was running, what people were responding to is they were like, "I just like that he just sort of talks the way that he talks, and that he's not talking like a politician, that he just sort of says what's on his mind," even though what was on his mind was just kind of nonstop racist dog whistles and misinformation. Like, so that wasn't great. But what they responded to was someone who felt like they were being themselves. Even though Trump is kind of incapable of telling the truth, his way of speaking in exclusively lies is sort of honest to the character of who he is. He's being honest to, like, who Donald Trump is, which is a liar. Donald Trump is a pathological, narcissistic liar. So, like, when he's up there being a pathological liar, he's being true to the nature of Donald Trump, and I think that's what people responded to. And so I think it's kind of smart of Beto O'Rourke's team to go, what people want to see is a person who has carte blanche to just speak his mind and to speak how he feels. And in this case, we have a person who actually has some good principles, and, like, who seems to have a decent moral backbone about things, and who seems to actually have some compassion and some humanity and some empathy. And when you let that person speak off the cuff, you might get a listen motherfucker when someone is laughing about kids dying in school. And I think that's an appropriate listen motherfucker, and a tip of the cap to Beto O'Rourke and the team. If that's how that came to pass. So let's move on to the main meat of the show, the main topic. I'm wearing my Dublin sweatshirt. Dublin, baby. On the last episode of this show, I talked about all the anticipatory fear I'd been having for months leading up to this Ireland trip that I was taking with my family. Somewhere along the way this year, I got it into my mind that I was going to have a hard time flying. I've been having a hard time flying during the pandemic. I've always had a hard time flying. I've always, like, gotten motion sick, and, like, flying's just uncomfortable. Flying in general, whether you get motion sick or not, whether you have anxiety or not, it's just, like, an inexcusably uncomfortable experience. It doesn't need to be as uncomfortable as it is. They don't need to make it that uncomfortable. It really doesn't need to be the way that it is. I wish that they could, that somehow that industry could just be like, hey, let's just get rid of like four or five rows on every plane and just charge everybody like $15 more per ticket. And they'll all just have more. I'm honestly like, I was talking about this with my brother. Like, don't give me a treat. Don't give me food or like, I don't care about the drink. I don't care about the treat. Give me more room. That's it. Just give me more room in a more comfortable seat. That's it. Just give me more space so that I can adjust over the course of a 5 or 6 hour long sitting session. That's it. I'll bring my own treats. I'll get my own treats at the Hudson News in the airport. I'll get my own drinks. I don't need the Biscoff cookie. I don't need you to do any of that. You can save on the overhead by having fewer flight attendants on the flight with not having to do so much service. Just give me more space. Make the experience more comfortable. So yeah, I've never really liked flying. On top of it just being a profoundly uncomfortable experience that doesn't need to be that uncomfortable, I do have anxiety, and I also have motion sickness. But, like, I've flown my whole life, and I figured out how to do it. Like, from the time I was a teenager, I just figured out that I just take this motion sickness medication called Bonine that makes me drowsy enough that I usually sleep through a flight. And I've mostly been okay with the process of flying. I even got to a point in my life at a certain point where I kind of enjoyed traveling and flying, because I would just sleep the whole time or I'd watch movies and I didn't really mind it. But for some reason during the pandemic, my anxiety about flying really went through the roof, and traveling has become really hard for me. Traveling by plane has become really hard for me. And every time I have to travel on a plane now, it causes me a lot of panic. And there's something about being in a pressurized cylinder with a bunch of people who I don't know what they have, and if they're sick, if they have COVID, I'm almost certainly going to get it. Even if I have a mask on, it doesn't matter. And then having anxiety and having a mask on at the same time, having anxiety that makes me feel like I can't breathe while there's a disease being spread around that affects your breathing, while wearing a mask that makes me feel like I can't breathe even more. It's just sort of a trifecta of ingredients that don't do wonders for my panic disorder. But I got it into my head earlier this year that this international flight, this 7 hour flight from the East Coast to Ireland, was going to be a problem, that I was going to have a panic attack on this pressurized cylinder over the Atlantic Ocean, and there wasn't going to be anything I could do about it. And I was just having fear almost on a daily basis, imagining this panic attack in this plane over the ocean, sitting next to a stranger, probably because I was traveling with my mom and dad and all of my siblings and their spouses, and I'm the only single person. So I was going to be sitting probably like, I'm imagining myself squished between two strangers, and I start having a panic attack, and neither one of them knows what's going on, but they can see that I'm breathing heavily. They ask me if I'm okay, and then that triggers me to just go and start crying and start freaking out, and now we don't know what to do. They're calling the attendants. I played out the whole scenario, all this anticipatory fear, months of anticipatory fear, thinking, even to the point of thinking, I might not make it. I might not make it to the flight. Like, at no point did I call my parents and say, hey, I don't think I can go on this trip. I constantly moved one foot in front of the other with the assumption that one way or another, I'm getting on this plane and I'm doing this trip. But if I'm being honest, I did have in my head that I can back out, and I'll feel really bad about it. But if I have to, if worse comes to worse, I can back out. I can always just say, I don't think I can go on the trip, and I'm so sorry. and try to make up for it in some other way. And but this is a trip we were taking for my mom's 70th birthday. It's something my parents have been planning for a couple of years. It was just like I had to try to make it on this trip. And I talked about it on the podcast, saying that I was the last episode I did, I said I'm heading out. I'm going to Salt Lake, and I'm heading to Ireland with my family. So, you know, like, here we go. Day of the trip shows up, and like, from the jump, from in the morning, I'm not feeling good. Like, I'm just, it's on top of me. I'm not feeling good. And I take all the medicine that I was going to take to try to calm myself down. I took some Bonine. I took a light dose of benzodiazepam, and took one other thing, this organic thing that I've been taking called L-theanine that my mom turned me on to. And I had all this stuff working, and I thought, this should be enough stuff that I shouldn't be able to hit the level to have a full-blown attack. I just might have to deal with some discomfort. We get to the Salt Lake Airport. The fact that I'm, like, through security and at the airport is a good sign. I think, cool, like, when I've had panic attacks that have prevented me from flying in the past, I didn't make it to the airport. Like, I couldn't, like, leave the house to get to the airport. So the fact that I got to the airport, bags packed, got through security, got to the gate, this was feeling good. Like, all I had to do was get on the plane. And at that point, it's kind of like, well, no turning back, because the only way back is on another plane, you know? So like, I can't just turn around and go, but you know, so I just had to get on the plane, and I made it all the way up till about 10 minutes before boarding. My sister comes into the gate, sits down next to me, looks at me, and I'm kind of just like in this zone. I'm listening to like meditative music in my headphones, and I'm just sort of like feeling generally uncomfortable. And she just looks at me and goes, "How you feeling?" And for some reason, that's a big trigger question for me when I'm on the cusp of a panic attack. Somebody asking, "How are you feeling?" is like the thing that knocks it over the edge, because I can't answer the question honestly without freaking out, without letting it all out. So I can't just say like, "I'm fine," you know, because that's not the truth. The truth is, I'm like, I'm barely keeping it together. Like, I'm barely holding it in. And she goes, "How are you feeling?" And I go to answer the question, and then I just go, and here it comes. And it right up to the surface, right up in my face mask, it's right there. And she knows instantly, "Ah, shit, I shouldn't have asked that." And I start crying, and I put my hands over my face, and I stand up and I walk away from the gate, and I'm pacing up and down the airport, crying, holding my chest, hyperventilating. And it's just all up on top of me. And I can't believe it too, because I've got like a good amount of like depressants in my system, and this thing is still pushing through. And as this is happening, they call for boarding the plane. Like, my family is getting on the plane, and people are asking me, "What do you need? What can we get for you? What do you need?" My dad's saying to me, "Look, if you need to stay, you can stay. It's okay. You can get an Uber home." My mom's saying, "No, don't stay. Don't stay. Just like, what can we do to get you on the plane?" You know? And I'm in a tunnel where I can't answer anybody's questions. I can't really think straight, because now I'm in full blown panic attack mode. But yeah, I did have this thought. I've been having this thought consistently leading up to the trip, thinking, there's no way I'm going to allow myself to go through 4 to 5 months of anticipatory fear and panic and anxiety and then not go on the trip. I'm not going to go through 4 or 5 months of I'm not even going to go through this panic attack I'm having right here in the airport and then not have the payoff of the trip. Like, that, I'm not going to allow myself to feel all of this discomfort and not have the payoff of what the discomfort was for, what it was all building toward. So I just think, okay, I don't feel good right now. I'm freaking out. But if I can get myself one step at a time onto this plane, then I'm on the plane and there's nothing to be done about it. And if my body wants to throw a fit and wants to freak out and cry and squirm, it can squirm all it wants, but we're on the plane and there's no getting off. And I just walked, panic attack in full swing, one step at a time onto that plane, sat down, put my seatbelt on. I was sitting next to my sister-in-law. She looks at me and goes, "How you doing?" I shook my head, put my headphones in, said, "Can't talk to you," and listened to some meditative music and just breathed. And the next thing I knew, as I was breathing, I fell asleep. Thank God. Woke up as the plane was taking off. Panic attack sort of came back a little bit. Breathed it off. Went back to sleep. Woke up. And from that moment on, I realized, okay, we did it. I think the body just needed to hit it. And we did it. We rode it out. Moved through the fear. Allowed the discomfort to exist. Didn't let it immobilize us. Didn't let it immobilize me. Moved through it. Allowed it. Gave it its time to do what it needed to do. And from that moment on, I had myself just the trip of a lifetime. Just an absolutely beautiful trip. You know, just every single day was more beautiful than the day before. Every single day, there were new things that I was seeing, new people I was meeting, new experiences I was having that were so needed and so welcome and so wonderful. And I'm so glad I made it onto that plane. And I'm so glad that I made it through that experience. And it's really helped me, this whole experience has really helped me come to a realization. And this is not a very novel realization. This is something that a lot of therapists preach, and a lot of people who work in this space, people who are professionals, anxiety researchers, and people who write books on anxiety, and Buddhists and yogis. This is something that a lot of wise people before me have been saying for a long time that I just never could grasp personally, which is this realization that like all this work I've been doing, going to therapy, getting sober, working a program through AA, all the, you know, like meditating, praying, doing yoga, stretching, trying to take care of my body, trying to monitor my eating and things like that. All of this work, I've had the idea, the mistaken assumption that what I'm trying to do is cure myself of my anxiety. I'm trying to figure out a way to rid myself of this anxiety, to live without it. To live a life that's free from it, that's free from the fear, that's free from the anxiety. And what I realized after this beautiful week I spent in Ireland, this trip that I was so nervous about, had so much anticipatory fear about, that turned out to be so beautiful, is the work that I'm doing is not so that I can rid myself of this anxiety. The work that I'm doing is so that I can understand my anxiety and my fear better. That I can understand these things as a fundamental aspect of my experience as an emotional being, as a conscious emotional being. I am never going to be able to rid myself of fear and worry and nervousness and panic. That's just not realistic. I can't get rid of those things. That's impossible. That's like the making the mistake of thinking that the point of meditation and of practicing meditation is to learn how to stop your brain from thinking. It's impossible. You can't stop your brain from thinking. That's what a brain does. That's what a mind does. A mind thinks. The point of meditation is not to learn how to cease thinking. Ceasing thoughts, ceasing thinking is ceasing to exist, is ceasing to be alive. That's what happens when you die. The point of meditation is not to learn how to stop thinking. The point of meditation is to learn how to understand your thoughts better, to see your thoughts as just that, as just thoughts, as transitory, as things that come in and go away, as things that move through you, as things that sometimes serve some utility, but most of the time are just sort of coming by to plop in a little song that pops into your head for a few hours, maybe even a few days, but it's transient. It'll come in and it'll leave. And that's the point of meditation, is to have a better understanding of what your thoughts are. So people sort of live with this chaos, these incessant thoughts, and it's so chaotic, and they have all of these intrusive thoughts and things like that. Meditation is just there to help you understand your intrusive thoughts better, so that you can see them with more compassion and see them with more of a kind, soft lens, and they're not so problematic in your day-to-day life anymore. And that's what I realized about my anxiety, is my goal is not to live without fear. That's impossible. That's impossible. My goal is to recontextualize my relationship with my fear, to see my fear when it comes up and go, ah, yes, there's that old familiar feeling that I've had a million times before that I will continue to have for as long as I'm alive, and to let it be and to move through it and to understand that it is transient, that it will pass like all things, and that it will come back, that it will pass and that I'll have the relief on the other side of it, and then it will come back at some other point. Trying to understand discomfort better. So this was the thing I had a really hard time with. I'm reading all these books by, you know, Buddhist teachers and people who are saying like, oh, we're not going to teach you how to rid yourself of pain or discomfort. We're going to teach you how to accept your pain and your discomfort and to regard your pain and your discomfort as part of your experience. And I had a problem with that because I was like, well, I don't understand that. I don't understand why part of being a conscious being requires that I'm uncomfortable sometimes, requires that in order to have good things, I need to have bad things. I don't understand why I have to move through discomfort in order to get to something beautiful or something worthwhile. Why does it have to be like that? Why can't the journey of life as a conscious being just be a happy one and an easy one? Why does it have to be difficult? I don't necessarily know that I'm any closer to answering that question of why, but I do think I understand a little bit more, and I'm coming to a realization that that shouldn't have been this hard for me to understand, which is that my anxiety has always been a part of really worthwhile things. My anxiety has always been a tool in my life that motivates me to move forward. It's sometimes the thing that gets me out of bed when I'm feeling depressed and having a hard time getting motivated and having a hard time getting started is a little bit of anxiety. It's a little bit of fear of like, well, you got that thing coming up. You got that deadline coming up. If you don't get out of bed now, you're going to miss it. And you're going to move backwards, and you're going to drop a lot of opportunities in the future. So you got to get up and do this stuff. My anxiety, my fear, my worry, that feeling, that nervosity, that sometimes that's the thing that sort of gives me the energy boost to get up and go. It's been really bothering me lately, and I've talked about this on the podcast, the anxiety that I've been getting when I perform live in front of people, whether I'm acting or whether I'm playing music in front of a group of people. It's been bothering me that I can't just do that comfortably, that I can't just wake up on the day of a show and go, I'm playing a show tonight, can't wait, and go through my whole day, do-do-do-do-do, go to the venue, hey everybody, play the show, and then it's been bothering me that I have to have discomfort on those days. And it's been bothering me so much that I've been thinking, well, do I even want to perform anymore? And what I realize is like, yeah, but every time I've had that discomfort and that nervosity, it's sort of given me access to a form of presence that I wouldn't have had if I was being just kind of, I don't know, blasé about the whole thing. So I've had access to a kind of like, I'm very present. I show up at the venue, I'm nervous. I'm very aware of everything that's going on, everything that's being said. I'm setting up, plugging my guitar in. I'm really seeing the room. I'm really in the space. I'm doing a play. I'm nowhere else. I'm not thinking about an interaction I had yesterday or something I'm nervous about tomorrow. I'm watching the audience file into this theater, and I'm in this play. When I go out on stage and I'm talking to the other actors, I am there. And that nervosity, that kind of hum of anxiety is the thing that sort of keeps me on my toes and moves me through these experiences. It's not the best feeling. So I don't want to say this to say like, turns out it's actually really great. It's still not like the best feeling, but what is a great feeling is the feeling of moving through that discomfort, the discomfort of being seen, of being vulnerable on a stage in front of people. The discomfort of being I was super embarrassed at the Salt Lake Airport having a panic attack in front of my family 5 minutes before we're getting on a plane. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. The vulnerability of that, moving through that, and then getting to the other side of that and seeing that it's possible to allow that transient discomfort to come up and fill you with the energy that you need to get up off your seat and move through whatever experience it is that you're nervous about. So seeing it, recontextualizing my anxiety as a sort of like biological helper assistant, a tool that moves me through challenges. I mean, think about it in your life. Anything that, for me at least, anything that I've ever been really proud of, any accomplishment that I've achieved, a challenge, whether it's a creative challenge or it's something in my personal life, like you know, getting sober, or going to therapy, any of these things, they are motivated, they are pushed and helped and moved along and accompanied by fear. Anytime I embark on a creative project that I really want to go well, there is a certain amount of worry that people aren't going to receive it the way that I want them to receive it, or that I'm not going to be able to execute this thing the way that I want to execute it. Think about any group project you've been a part of, or any, I mean, like planning a wedding. You know, you're planning what's supposed to be the most beautiful, amazing, happy day of your life. And it's accompanied by all kinds of stress, financial stress, stress about, do we remember to invite all the right people? Who should we invite? Who should we leave off the invite list? Just the venue, all the stuff that goes into planning a wedding, all for one day. And then the stress of being like, I better enjoy this day because I went through all months and months and months of preparation and anxiety and worry and stress. And not just me, but family members coordinating who's going to do what. All of this stress for this one day, but it all leads to this payoff of this thing that is scary for a lot of people, standing in front of friends and family and committing to someone else for life. I'm going to be with you. I'm doing this. That's a very scary move. A lot of people have a lot of fear about commitment, about making a choice like that, you know? And having accompanying fear and accompanying anxiety is normal. It's a normal part of being an emotional, conscious being, you know? So yeah, I guess that's what I'm talking about today, is just that recontextualization of my relationship with anxiety and realizing that the work that I'm doing is not so that I can live without fear. It's so that I can live in a world where I understand my fear better and I see it as a tool. Now, I have been diagnosed with panic disorder, which means that your panic is at a point where it impairs functionality. So there have been times in my life where I haven't been able to do a thing that I need to do. Make it to an audition, make it through an audition, do a performance, fly on a plane. There have been things where I've gone, I can't do that. I can't make it there. And I have not been able to do the thing I needed to do because my panic impaired my ability to do it. That is a problem. That is something that needs to be addressed. So there is, I can see utility in medication and in therapy for trying to lessen the severity of the discomfort that comes with panicking and anxiety so that it's not so severe that it's impairing your ability to function in the world. I absolutely recognize that, and I know that from firsthand experience. But also I think that part of lessening the severity of it is changing your relationship to it, is changing the way that you see it. I'm even feeling right now, and this is, you know, I'm speaking early here because it's only been like a week and a half since my last panic attack, which was at the Salt Lake Airport, but I'm already feeling very optimistic about the future going forward just with this reframe, that the next time I have anticipatory fear about something or fear coming up about a project or about some new challenge that I'm trying to take on in my life, I can recognize it and go, that's supposed to be there. That's normal, and that's okay, and that's helping me move through this difficult thing, or that's helping me get ready for this exciting thing that I have coming up. Just that reframe is something that's got me really excited. Okay, I've talked long enough. Let's turn it over to TikTok. Most of the people on TikTok have left because I talked for way too long, but let's see if TikTok or YouTube has anything to add to the conversation. Liliana on TikTok just asked, do you have a podcast? If not, you should. I wonder if Liliana is being serious with that question, because I don't know how they couldn't have noticed that I'm talking into a microphone right now and I'm not looking at the TikTok camera. I'm looking like off screen at a different thing. That's because I'm looking into a camera that's broadcasting live to YouTube, and this is the live broadcast of the podcast. So you're at it. Welcome to it. So Scores Galore 2 on TikTok says, exactly, you can learn to keep it in check, though. And so I think that this is sort of what I was talking about functional impairment, that like you don't want your anxiety and your fear so intense and your experience of those things so intense that you're incapable of functioning, that you can't get anything done, because then it's not being a tool that helps you move through challenging things. It's just a club that you're being bludgeoned with into submission, and you're not getting anything done. So keeping it in check, so to say, I think would be through a process of therapy, perhaps medication, but like exercise, meditation, things like this, learning how to see it differently so that you can, quote unquote, keep it in check, so that you can keep it, the experience of it, at a level where it's not so intense that it impairs your ability to move through it. But I really do think that this reframe, just this reframe, helps, you know. And also I think what happened too to me in Salt Lake is a little bit of exposure therapy, which is that I was able to experience the thing that I was having all the anticipatory fear about, all the fear months building up to this trip. It happened. I had the panic attack there in Salt Lake. It came up and it came gushing out. Here it was, all of my fears manifest, and I was able to sit in that moment and go, okay, well, here it is. I don't think it's going to get much worse than this. If we can move through this and get on the plane, we should be all right. That happened. I talked about this on the podcast a couple weeks ago, how I had that show that I was playing in LA, and I showed up to the venue, and right when I walked into the venue, I started having a panic attack, and I told the people at the venue, I was like, I'm kind of having a panic attack, texted my friends, I don't know if I'm going to play tonight, I'm having a panic attack, but I stayed in the venue, and I stayed in the panic, and I just was like, don't go home, you're not going to like it if you go home, stay here, and let this feeling do what it needs to do. And that, And I've been told this too. I've been told this by a couple therapists and by other people in my life, that I should try to let the panic happen and not try to avoid it or repress it or push it down when it happens. And that suggestion scared the hell out of me as a person who knows how uncomfortable and painful panic can be. I was like, I don't want to just let it do what it does. But also the realization that it's like, when it's happening, I don't really get a say in turning it on or off anyway. So I might as well just try to like allow it to be there and have sort of a gentle regard for it and a softness with it. And I think that going through things like that, exposure therapy, where you experience the fear that you were worried about having, you let it happen and you do the thing that you have the fear about, you move through it, that's really healthy in helping keep it in check down the road. Let's see. David on YouTube says, we gonna talk about the nukes? I have no idea what David on YouTube is talking about. Anybody know what David's talking about? The nukes? Just in general? Just like nuclear weapons in general? Or did something happen with nukes recently? I don't know what he's talking about. Somebody on Ballsy2970 on TikTok just said Trump/nukes. Again, everyone's saying things and I don't know what that means. Someone just said nuke Ohio. I don't know what that means. Trump/nukes. I don't know what that means. I don't know what nuke Ohio means. Trump. I don't know what that means. What do you mean? What do you mean? Okay, so now someone's explaining it. Part of the raid on Trump was him taking classified nuclear data. All right, cool. Yeah, that's a. I could have talked about that on the Bad Take Brigade. Trump getting raided and all of the Republicans saying defund the FBI and, oh, this is such a travesty. This is such a travesty. It's so funny that like Republicans and conservatives are, if you say anything bad about America, they will be right down your throat. How dare you disrespect this country? how dare you disrespect this country? But the second that, like, the country does something they don't like, they're like, this country's so fucked up. they flip so fast the second that law enforcement or the FBI or the government does something that they don't like. It's instantly like, this country's just fucking pathetic, ridiculous. We need to burn the whole thing to the ground. Civil war. It's time for a civil war, you know. Aries here on TikTok says, if they can do this to Trump, they can do this to you. That's been the big talking point on Fox News and on Twitter. If they can do this to Trump, they can do this to you. You don't say. If you break the law, is what the comment says. And it's like, yeah, it's like, did you know that? I mean, if they can investigate Trump for breaking the law, they can investigate you for breaking the law. It's like, well, hopefully. I don't know how to pronounce this name. It's J-E-A-N-N-I-E. Jeannie, I think. Jenny? Jeannie? I'm going to say Jeannie. I'm scared I'm pronouncing it wrong. Jeannie says, I'm glad you talked about your anxiety. Going on vacay next week. I needed to hear that. Well, good. That's why I wanted to talk about it, is if you have anything, because sometimes it's frustrating to have, like, exciting things coming up. Like, I was going on an amazing trip, the trip of a lifetime, and I wasn't able to, like, be excited about it. I was just scared, and that was a bummer. But, you know, I think if I had had this reframe before and been able to just go, oh no, I just have anticipatory nerves because that's what happens to me when I have exciting stuff coming up in my life, and it's okay, it's gonna be great. And I think I could have lessened it, and I could have, as the earlier commenter said, kept it in check a little bit, because the reality was, like, I had a great time. And the thing is like, leading up to it, I was frustrated with the anticipatory fear because I knew I was most likely going to have a great time. Anytime someone asked me, like, well, what are you afraid of happening? I was like, no, honestly, I'm sure I'm going to have a fantastic trip. I'm more scared that I'm just going to get scared, and that's what's frustrating. So I think that's what's helpful about this reframe, is like, my panic disorder manifests usually in I get scared about getting scared. Now, if I can employ this reframe where I can just go, there's nothing wrong with getting scared. Getting scared is something that's just going to happen. It's going to continue happening for the rest of my life. If I ever wind up having kids, I'm going to be nervous about having kids. I'm going to be worried about that in the 9 months leading up to the birth of my first child. There's going to be a lot of anticipatory fear, but then it's going to be a really beautiful thing. And, like, it's going to continue happening through my life. You're going to get job promotions and opportunities professionally. And you're going to, like, have things come into your life that are good things that are going to cause you to have anticipatory fear. And seeing that and going, there's nothing wrong with that. It's okay to have that. That's part of the experience of, like, to have joy, to have ecstasy, you also have to have the opposite of that, which is discomfort and pain and fear. And understanding it as an okay thing to have that doesn't need to have, like, shame or anger attached to it, because that's a lot of my problem, is I have a lot of shame about my panic, and I get really mad about it. So, like I said, it's embarrassing for me. When it happens, it's embarrassing. And I feel embarrassed about the fact that as a 34-year-old man, I still have a hard time controlling an emotional outburst of fear in public with a bunch of people around. I start crying because someone asks me how I'm doing. That's embarrassing, and there's a lot of shame attached to that. Freeing myself of that and saying, it's okay, I don't need to be ashamed of the fact that I feel anticipatory fear about exciting things in my life. That's a really, like, big revelation that I've had. And so I hope you can carry that into your trip. Tim Writes Music on TikTok says, it's not the emotion, it's the reaction to the emotion. Yeah, and I think that's something that they talk about in AA a lot too, is like, I can't help my first reaction. Something happens, somebody cuts me off in traffic. I can't really help my first thought. My first thought is often like, it's fear, right? I have a fear response because I'm driving in a big metal death machine at 75 miles per hour, and somebody cut me off in a way that made me swerve or slam on my brakes and made me think, you could have just hurt me or other people around me. And I have a fear response that converts into anger in a split second. And I think, motherfucker, fuck you. How dare you? You know, I can't really help that first reaction, but I can hopefully move with practice and with intentional practice and mindfulness. I can have a pause and go, say, you know, even saying the word to myself, peace. My friend John says this to me, that in the car, and I've been using this, that in the car when that happens, something happens, somebody cuts him off or somebody does something that bothers him, he has his first reaction, the anger reaction, and then he just says to himself, peace. It's just a reminder, what do I want? What do I want out of this situation? I want peace. Just reminding myself, peace. Whatever that, I don't know that person's situation, I don't know who that person is, and I hope that person gets to where they're going safely and in one piece, and I just want peace in my life right now. I don't want to be resentful and mad at this person the whole drive, and that is a practice, you know? So it's not the emotion, it's the reaction to the emotion. You're going to have the emotion, you're going to have emotional responses and things that stimulate your emotion and emotions in different ways. That's a part of your experience as a conscious being. Now you can just let your emotions run wild and have no practice to try to mitigate your response to them at all. And I think that's what's happening in people before they enter into therapy or before they enter into any kind of meditative practice or mindfulness practice, is you're just sort of, it's just sort of your emotions run wild in your body, and you're just sort of constantly subject to all day long fear, anger, despair, joy, laughter, fear, and there's no pause to examine the thing. So again, just like the point of meditation is not to learn how to stop thinking, it's how to learn how to observe your thoughts and to understand your thoughts better and to see them for what they are. That's like the point. I think the point of therapy and the point of working on anxiety and depression is not to free yourself of anxiety and depression. It's to learn how to, when depression comes up, when it's there, to learn how to have that pause, that separation from it, to see it and go, oh yeah, this is just a part of my experience. This is a thing that happens from time to time. It's transient. It comes and goes. It's here now. It won't be at another point. And the same thing with anxiety, the same thing with anger, those quick reactions, those emotions. The practice can be, the mindfulness practice can be just to see those things and go, oh yeah, that's right. I'm reading this book right now, and there's a meditative practice where, just like my friend John who says the word peace, the teacher is saying that when you're having anticipatory fear and you're catastrophizing and you're planning and you're thinking of all the different contingencies and ways that things could go, and it's causing you to feel anticipatory discomfort, in a moment where it's not really pragmatic for you to be feeling that, like there's no reason why you should be feeling that right, you know, 3 weeks before the thing, you can just remind yourself with just the simple word thinking. Oh, thinking. And not in a judgmental way, so free of shame, no shame about it, no like, oh God, there goes my stupid brain again, catastrophizing, thinking of all the worst case scenarios, but just reminding yourself, oh yeah, thinking, I'm just thinking about different things that could happen. That's right. And just that simple word as a reminder to return, to return right here, to return to the present moment. So the emotion is there, you can't control that, it's gonna happen. Accepting that it's going to happen, accepting that our brains are going to continue to think, are going to continue to jump into the future and think about the past and go all over the place and go diagonal in every which way. And we can just go thinking and bring it back. And that practice, that just sort of mindfulness practice, can help you hone how you respond to the inevitable emotional ride that you're going to be on as a living being. Alyssa Rose again on TikTok says, what are your thoughts or experiences with being in a relationship with someone who doesn't have anxiety? You know, I think that people experience this on a spectrum, like all things. No one alive is free of fear. Like nobody doesn't have the experience of like fear or worry or nerves. Everyone to some extent understands that experience, but certainly not everyone has the experience of someone like, say, me with panic disorder, who like will regularly be in a situation where I'll be barely containing a flood of overwhelming fear and emotion. And if someone just asks me, how are you feeling? Or you look a little shaken right now, how you doing? I'm going to burst the dam. You know, that's not everyone's experience. So I have encountered people, I think, in my life who it's been harder for them to empathize because they see me going through the experience that I'm going through. And it maybe looks like I'm being dramatic or like I'm playing up the experience to get some kind of, I don't know, attention or just to be kind of grandiose about it. I don't know. So those situations can be difficult. I think when it comes to being in a relationship with someone who doesn't really fully understand it, and I have been, I've definitely been in relationships with people who didn't have or didn't experience panic to the level that I did. And I think I've been very fortunate in the past. I've had people who have been very supportive of the level that I experience it at, and when I'm experiencing it, have been very good about sitting with me and holding my hand and being very kind and soft with me. So I guess I would say if you're with a partner who can't offer you that kind of compassion and empathy when you're in the midst of a panic attack, if you're with someone who like doesn't understand it to the point of like making fun of you or degrading you about it or adding to your feeling of shame about it, I would say maybe that's not a healthy relationship to be in. I'm not going to go out on this podcast and be like Dan Savage and tell anyone to break up with anyone. But I am saying that if you're with a partner who can't support you or at least have compassion for the emotional experience that you're having, that might not be the healthiest situation. But I think the all you can really ask from someone who doesn't fully understand it to the extent of like what a full-blown panic attack feels like is that they can believe you when you're expressing to them what your experience is like, and they can support you by believing you. It's kind of like, you know, like I will never know what PMS feels like. Like I don't know what it's like to monthly menstruate. I don't know what that physiological experience is like. But I can believe my partner when they tell me that they're uncomfortable and that they're going through like that they're frustrated or that they're like, you know what, I just need like today's not a good day. I'm my body doesn't feel good. I can trust them and do what I can as a partner to support them and to try to ease their discomfort in that moment. So I don't know if that answers the question. Stegastories says, empathy is huge. I don't need your sympathy. I just want empathy in those moments. I think that's exactly right. It's like, I don't need you necessarily to like feel bad for me. I just need you to like believe me and try to relate by imagining sometime that you felt overwhelmingly uncomfortable and inexplicably uncomfortable from an emotional stimulus. If they can't do that, if they can't try to offer you the space to sometimes be in emotional distress, maybe it's not the healthiest relationship. Tim writes, music says, I think it's also important to have people in your life who are able to identify with your experience. Yeah, definitely. I think that if you have no one in your life who knows what a panic attack feels like, and you're the only person you know who knows what a panic attack feels like, yeah, maybe seek out an online community or something somewhere just so that you know that you're not alone. But it is nice to have friends or people in your life who know what it's like. Yeah, because Tim also writes, describing a panic attack to someone who's never had one is so different to someone to describing one to someone who's been there. And that's true. It's really hard to explain to someone who's never had a panic attack what a panic attack feels like. I've tried to explain it so many times, and even when I'm trying to explain it, I know that the words I'm saying aren't doing it justice. It's kind of like trying to take a photo of like the moon or of a sunset, and you're just kind of like, I just can't get it. Like, I can't. I know that this is like an approximation of what I'm looking at, but this is not. It's not encapsulating the fullness of what I'm looking at. And when you're explaining it to someone who has had a panic attack, and you're kind of like, you know, like the vision, how it's sort of like it sort of starts like shaking, and they're like, yeah, I know what you're talking about. And you're like, and like the extremities start tingling, and you can feel, you know, that it's coming up, and they just understand. McJet asks, what do you think about stoicism? I don't think much about it because I don't really know much about it. I would have to study more about stoicism. Maybe I'll have someone on the podcast who wants to talk about stoicism. I know that's a thing that there are a lot of people who study and know a lot about. Maybe that'd be a good guest to have on to talk to me about stoicism. Yeah, my buddy Before the Crow's Nest, Chris, who's been on the show before, Christopher Schenefeldt, who was a guest on the episode Anti-Mormon Literature. That's a book that he wrote. You should go check it out. But Chris talked about on that episode about how he suffers from chronic pain, and he popped in here and said, hey, friend, trying to explain chronic pain to almost anyone else has always been difficult. Yeah, and so I imagine it's like that, where you're just like, I don't really know how to explain to you if you don't suffer from chronic pain. It's kind of like, yeah, when I, like, when I tell people my back hurts, because people will be like, well, how's your back? And I'll go like, oh, it hurts. And they'll be like, well, what happened? I'm like, oh, no, it just always hurts. Sometimes it hurts worse than other days, but it never doesn't hurt. It always hurts. And people don't really they're like, well, what'd you do? What happened? I'm like, no, I didn't do anything. It just always does hurt. And it hurts in different areas, and it hurts in different ways. And some days it hurts worse than other days, but it never doesn't hurt. And sometimes I'm able to just like not really think about it for prolonged periods of time. And so I'm not really like aware of the pain, but if I like think about it, it's like, oh yeah, it's there, you know? People don't really, you know, understand it. But I think that talking about this stuff is good. So that's what we're doing. We're talking about it. And I wanted to share that revelation that I had from going on my trip, doing a little exposure therapy, going on the trip, had some amazing experiences in Ireland. Dublin's a great city. Donegal was just beautiful. I took this day trip to Donegal. My sister-in-law is obsessed with Enya, and Donegal is where Enya's from, and she wanted to see where Enya grew up and the landscapes that inspired Enya's music. And we listened to Enya while we were driving through Donegal, and it really felt like those landscapes. You're like, oh, now I understand this music a lot better. It really did work. We went to the tavern that Enya's father started, and it's sort of this family tavern. And we go in there, and Enya's niece was our server. It was crazy. It was really magical. Then my buddies, Bressy and Louise, who I met in March, they came to LA and they hit me up on Instagram and they were like, hey, we're fans of your content. Could we meet up? We're in LA. They came over and hung out. There are these two cool Irish people. And I told them, and I came out to Ireland and said, hey, I'm in Ireland. Let's hang out. And Brezzy said, I'm playing this festival in Mullingar. You should come. Turns out he's like a super famous guy in Ireland. And I should have realized that, but I guess I didn't realize the extent to which he's like a really big deal over there. And it was really cool. I got to watch him play live on TV with this festival with like 500,000 people in this really small little town. It was crazy. It was amazing. I'm so glad I went and that I was able to have this experience of this kind of minor breakthrough of realizing that the journey that I'm on is not to cure my anxiety, but to recontextualize my relationship to it. And I hope that that's useful for you. I hope you found this useful. Thanks for the comments on YouTube. Thanks for the comments on TikTok. Thanks for hanging out and sticking with me. I am sweating in this sweatshirt. It's hot in here. It's been hot in LA. I got to kick the AC back on. Thanks for hanging out. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. My new album is out on Spotify and Apple Music, and you can buy the double vinyl. You can pre-order it starting Friday, August 12th. when this podcast episode should be out on Spotify, you can listen to the album on Spotify or Apple Music, and you can order the double vinyl on Bandcamp, the exclusive limited edition double vinyl. We got 30 days to fulfill those orders. I hope you'll check it out. Patreon.com/AustinArcher if you want to support this show. You want to know a free way that you can support this show? So there's obviously joining Patreon. There's obviously getting the album on Bandcamp, all that stuff. But a free way, if you don't have any money, subscribe to my YouTube. Check out, we're doing the video version. We got the video version of the podcast rocking on YouTube. We're looking great with the Sony camera hooked up. We're looking good over here on YouTube. I got content being posted to YouTube every single day. Subscribe to my YouTube. That would be a good help. All right. That's it. Thanks for hanging out. Thanks for the comments. Thanks for the feedback. Love y'all so much. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. And we'll talk next week. Bye-bye. So much you push it off, your life is the same.